Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 24th, 2021. I'm your reader, Twyla Glenn. The lead story today is headlined Piasta Projects Rise, and it's accompanied by two full-color photographs. The first photograph shows construction continuing on a student housing project on the west end of Northeast Iowa Community College campus in Piasta. The other photograph shows construction beginning on a tap room being built along Thunder Valley Drive between Thunder Hills and Cox Springs Road in Piasta. And here's the story. Current and upcoming construction in Piasta gave the city council and the city staff a stack of development agreements to consider this week. Piasta city council members this week unanimously approved four development agreements with tax increment financing incentives, and they discussed a fifth. The city has negotiated agreements with incentives for developers supporting projects such as community college housing, a tap room, and a coffee shop. The city will provide financial assistance in the form of incremental property tax rebates that each developer will use to construct and maintain each project. An agreement with Crosvik Development was also set to be approved. The council opted to leave the agreement for a later meeting after Crosvik representatives said they had some questions about the agreement. Crosvik Development sold two of its lots to Thunder Valley LLC and Caldman Real Estate LLC to build a tap room associated with Dimensional Brewing Company and a Jumble Coffee Company location. Crosvik is developing another 22 lots for residential and commercial uses. Brett Crosby, and Slavik Nokanevny of Crosvik Development attended this week's meeting. The discussed agreement would only provide the rebate to cover commercial development. Crosvik Development officials had expected the agreement would also cover residential development. What we've got in front of us is an agreement in writing, but we don't necessarily have a common understanding of how this agreement should play out, Mayor Jim Merton said. City officials said recent turnover in the staff likely caused the misunderstanding. Though new city administrator Annette Ernst attended her first city council meeting this week, she had not yet been hired when the city was working out agreements with the developers. Interim City Administrator Doug Herman presented the agreements to the council Tuesday, but he also was not a part of the initial discussions. Herman currently serves as city attorney. Herman worked from notes left by former City Administrator Whitney Bethke, who has worked as an economic development coordinator for the City of Des Moines since April. All three recent administrators were at the meeting Tuesday. Herman and Ernst attended in person, and Bethke answered questions via Zoom. The council decided to hold off on giving final approval to the Crosvik Development Agreement in order to rewrite it and ensure both parties fully understand it and agree with the terms. The council also discussed the Piasta Square Development Agreement. Piasta Square, a project of developer Wes Schulte, will be located in Piasta Commercial Park. Schulte plans to construct a three-story building with commercial businesses on the bottom level and housing on the second and third floors. Unlike with Crosvik, the infrastructure serving this development, the Piasta Square development, largely exists, Herman said. Over the course of 20 years, the tax rebate payments will not exceed $1.5 million under the agreement. The incentives are tied only to incremental property taxes created by commercial development on the first floor. Herman said he will look into other incentives that could apply to the residential part of the structure. The council approved the agreement and also approved a resolution to support Schulte in applying for state workforce housing tax credits for the property. The next development agreement was with College Suites LLC for housing for Northeast Iowa Community College students. Herman said the project has a commercial connection because it is tied to NICC. It's for the benefit and growth and stability of the college, Herman said. And because all those things and the commercial connection, this is eligible to be treated as a commercial improvement. Under the agreement, college suites will receive a rebate of 85% of incremental property tax revenues with a maximum amount of $2 million over 15 years. The city also approved an agreement with Thunder Valley LLC, developer of the tap room associated with Dimensional Brewing Company, with a rebate of 85% of incremental property tax revenues with a maximum amount of $300,000 over 15 years. The coffee shop and brewery have been the battle cry ever since I got here, and from my understanding, long before I was in Piasta, Bethke said. Herman said, the only unique thing with this is they also negotiated a forgivable loan. The loan is worth $50,000 and is only forgivable if the developers finish construction and the business remains open in 6 years. For the Kalbman development, which will become the home of a Jumble Coffee Company location, the council approved a rebate of 85% of incremental property tax revenues with a maximum amount of $200,000 over 15 years. I will just comment that this is a fantastic thing for Piasta, Merton said. Also on the front page, supervisors lament the pace of vaccinations. Members of the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors voiced frustration this week with what they see as slowing momentum in the county's fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. During a regular report on pandemic response, Dubuque County Health Department Executive Director Patrice Lambert and County Auditor Kevin Dragato discouraged the idea of offering cash incentives to county residents to get vaccinated. Lambert also rejected the idea of offering vaccinations at bars or events with live entertainment. Following these sentiments and news that the county's vaccination site at Kennedy Mall will now close after this week, Supervisor Ann McDonough expressed her dissatisfaction. I feel like we're running out of juice, Patrice, she told Lambert. You sound exhausted, and that's understandable. If we're unsure about incentives or prizes, we're closing the Kennedy Mall site, and the big signs are coming down. What are we doing? We're here in the home stretch. Where's the momentum? The pace of vaccinations has slowed dramatically in Dubuque County in the past month. Just 2,101 county residents had completed vaccinations so far this month as of Friday, June 19, the lowest of any month since vaccines were first available in January. The highest month was April, when 17,443 county residents were vaccinated. And while Dubuque County still has the second highest vaccination rate of all Iowa counties, health officials said 3,200 more residents, adults, would have to get their first vaccine to reach 70% of the county's adult population, in line with President Joe Biden's national goal. If I can get on somebody's radar who might just be surviving, getting their child to daycare, getting to work, just moving through life, that was me in my 20s, with the opportunity of a big incentive, that's going to make that person likely to get a vaccine because it will make their to-do list, McDonough said. Last week, supervisors asked Lambert to look into cash incentives, similar to those offered by retailers and other county governments in the state. At this week's meeting, McDonough pointed to Polk County's lottery for a $50,000 prize open to vaccinated residents. Lambert said she consulted Polk County officials and met with Dubuque County department heads about what would be needed to do that. Dragato firmly opposed cash incentives because of the procedural challenges involved. Anyone we would give a check to would receive a 1099 tax form as part of our standard government business, he said. Moving toward an item or prize-based system may be a better value than cash. Dragato proposed options such as a car giveaway or a series of smaller prizes. Supervisor Jay Wickham said he thought a blend of the two ideas could succeed. I'm generally in favor of some kind of reward system, he said. I tend to favor the Minnesota model that has a series of various incentives, the Aquarium Pass, the Mall of America Pass, the Fishing License, the State Park Pass, or a $25 Visa card. Supervisor Harley Ponthoff said he was generally against the county offering incentives. "The majority of the people who have gotten it out of respect for community and for themselves," he said. "I don't know that an incentive is necessarily going to bring a lot more people into vaccination, but I'll listen to ideas." Supervisors again directed Lambert to return with proposals for an incentive program. In the meantime, Lambert said she and the Dubuque County COVID-19 Incident Management Team would continue their current efforts. "We're not going to stop," Lambert said. "We're going to continue to take the vaccinations to the events where the people are." A caveat is that those events cannot feature alcohol, she said, though McDonough pushed back against that. "Who in Dubuque County is going out to meet the 25-year-olds at a bar?" McDonough asked. "Isn't that the unvaccinated group?" "The under-vaccinated group?" she asked. Other cities are doing that, hosting these where people are having live entertainment. If it's a beer tent, it's a beer tent. Lambert said that unless she was specifically directed to do so, she and the incident management team were staying away from bars and alcoholic events. "That is basically for the liability legal issues," she said. "If anything were to happen after we gave a vaccine, some people would not know if it happened due to the vaccine or due to the alcohol the person had consumed." McDonough directed Lambert to find out where the liability lies so that the county might work around it. The Board of Supervisors also recently discussed continuing the point of distribution site in the former Yonkers Women's Store past the end of June, when its lease sunsets, against the recommendations of the incident management team. But Lambert reported this week that the space is unavailable starting in July. The last day for appointments and walk-in vaccinations at the site will be 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. this Friday. After that, the Visiting Nurse Association will accept appointments and walk-ins at their Dubuque office at 660 Iowa Street. Vaccines also are available at most area pharmacies, in addition to pop-up sites and public events. And the final article on the front page is Resurrection Breaks Ground for School. Project is scheduled to be completed by the fall of 2022. This article is accompanied by a full-color photograph of the Reverend Phil Gibbs, pastor of Church of the Resurrection, leading a prayer during a groundbreaking ceremony for Resurrection Elementary School on Wednesday. And here's the story. After years of planning, Church of the Resurrection and Holy Family Catholic Schools officials held a groundbreaking ceremony for a new Resurrection Elementary School building Wednesday in Dubuque. "I'm thinking about Father Joseph Hauer today because Father Hauer was the catalyst of the whole project and such an advocate of Catholic schools," Resurrection Principal Denise Grant said. "So I'm thinking of him today and how much he is smiling down from heaven." The Reverend Joseph Hauer, who died in August, served Resurrection Parish for 16 years before his retirement 3 years ago. "It's been a few years in the coming, but this was something he always wanted," Grant said. Now, school and church officials hope the project to construct a new 3-story building will be completed over the next year. "We've been taking it up for quite a while, so it's nice to have a start," said the Reverend Phil Gibbs, pastor of the Church of the Resurrection. Builders currently are cleaning out asbestos from the old building and then will demolish a wing of the current school to make way for the new building. The new school is scheduled to be completed by the fall of 2022. "I'm excited about the opportunity that awaits our students," Holy Family Chief Administrator Philip Borman said. Holy Family and Resurrection Parish both are contributing to the $8.6 million project. "We've been able to already raise the funds for our commitment pledged to Resurrection," Borman said. "An anonymous donor also has pledged $2.5 million. When people see the project underway, that gives them the confidence that this is actually a real thing," Gibbs said. Gibbs said the church still has $600,000 left to raise out of $3.05 million. Grant said the school community is enthusiastic for the new space. "I'm just so excited for all of our kids and our families and the parish and Holy Families," she said. "It's just really exciting for all of us." Still, she acknowledged that students and staff will miss the old school, too. "On the last day of school, the teachers were finally realizing that this is no longer going to be there," Grant said. "We've spent so many years here, and there are so many memories here." When Mary Jo Dalsing thinks of Resurrection Elementary School, she remembers cornfields and a narrow old road leading to the school at the edge of town. Dalsing attended Resurrection from first grade in 1966 until eighth grade in 1974. She stayed in Dubuque and is currently the secretary at Resurrection. "It was kind of a rural parish then," Dalsing said. "For a long time, Resurrection was the end of the city limits. For more recent students, the school has been surrounded by a more urban environment as Dubuque and Asbury have grown around it. Future students can look forward to even more changes, though the school will still be located on the same plot." "It has served the parish well," Dalsing said. "When it was built back in the 1960s, it was supposed to be a temporary structure and replaced later." Incoming Resurrection kindergartner Jack Muller attended the groundbreaking with his mother, Holy Family Director of Enrollment Rebecca Muller. Jack and his fellow Resurrection students will spend the next year during school year learning in the school buildings on the St. Anthony Catholic Church campus during construction. Muller said her son is excited for the new school. Jack nodded in agreement. "I think it's going to be a really great environment for the kids," Muller said. And turning to page 2, the first thing we see is a lovely full-color photograph of the riverboat Twilight departing Dubuque and passing under the Julian Dubuque Bridge as it makes its way back downriver to LeClaire, Iowa, yesterday. Moving now to the articles on the second page, the first one is Platteville Museums Look to the Future. A new plan is presented for mining and Rollo Jamison Museums. This from Platteville, Wisconsin. A new site plan for Platteville's Mining and Rollo Jamison Museums envisions a campus that better reflects the institution's connections to science, technology, conservation, industry, art, and the humanities. The vision, presented this week to the Platteville Common Council, includes a sweeping redesign of the grounds located behind the Rock School and Hanmer Robbins School buildings, and a reorganization of their interiors to improve staff efficiency and enhance visitors' experiences. This plan really celebrates the future of the museums to ensure that the deep lessons they have for the community can continue for generations to come, said Museum Director Eric Flesch. Staff from Kabbalah Washtow Architects, a Cedarburg firm, oversaw the creation of the plan. The plan proposes a redesign of the building entrance, which is flanked by the two schools. "The entrance is tucked back and is dwarfed by the grand nature of these buildings," said Andrew Peters, project architect. "An outdoor sculpture and mural would be added to draw more attention to the entryway." The Hanmer Robbins School, constructed in 1905, currently serves as the primary exhibition space and is handicapped accessible. The plan would see the repurposing of its topmost floor from collection storage to galleries. Museum staff members are continuing to catalog and selectively winnow the institution's collection to create space, the plan stated. The Rock School, which dates to 1860, also has lost exhibit space to storage. It is accessible only to staff. "Allowing the public into this building is absolutely imperative," said Wayne Reckert, a marketing director for the architectural firm. The plan indicates that the ground level will be reutilized as additional exhibition and classroom space, while the upper level would continue as an archive. Meanwhile, employee offices in the Hanmer Robbins School would be relocated so guests could walk through the foyer with direct access to the rear campus. Wayfinding and educational signs would be installed throughout the grounds, along with paths that provide a clear direction visitors should follow as they navigate the premises. The walkway would wind through native landscapes and connect to covered pavilions and a plaza. The 1845 Bevens Lead Mine, which enables visitors to tour a historic mine that stretches underneath the grounds, is accessible by a depot, which the architects believe could be transformed into a hub for outdoor activities. The plane structure could be upgraded by installing a covered platform for people to board the 1932 mine locomotive that travels the grounds. The tracks would be fenced off, and a new outdoor play area would be created. Council member Kim Killian questioned whether maintenance of the outdoor improvements would strain city coffers, but Flesch said planners intentionally focused on light construction. Nonetheless, implementation of the master plan will take years and come to a cost well over $1 million. Flesch said he intends to start requesting funds in the museum's annual city budgets. The nonprofit fundraising arm affiliated with the institution also intends to launch a capital campaign. Also on page 2, this article headlined Conservation Board and Schools to Share Naturalists. The Dubuque County Conservation Board recently approved an agreement with Dubuque Community Schools to split costs and time of a new full-time naturalist. The staffer would manage a district-wide outdoor adventures program that offers science curricula for pre-kindergarten through fifth grade students. A lot of the science standards can be taught in an outdoor setting, said Julie Lang, the district's director of digital literacy, who took the lead in developing the program. Kids are then getting a real-life experience, and we know all of the social-emotional experiences that come with kids being outdoors. Under the agreement, the two entities would split the position's salary and benefits at $30,000 each. The Dubuque Community School Board will still have to approve the agreement. The program would begin next year. While all students in fifth grade and younger would take part in the program, their lessons would differ by grade. The pre-K track is called Growing Up Wild and would keep students on their school's campus but still get them outside. Kindergarten classes would follow a What's the Habitat track with half-day lessons at Swiss Valley Nature Preserve and the Nature Center. First grade classes would study astronomy. Second graders would study water, rocks, and soil at their school's campuses. In third grade, classes would learn about life on the prairie and native furs and skulls with full-day lessons at either Mines of Spain State Recreation Area or Whitewater Canyon Wildlife Area. Fourth grade classes would cover geology, both fossils and landforms, with full-day courses at Swiss Valley. In fifth grade, classes would spend two full-day lessons focused on wetlands and on woodlands. The new naturalist would serve as a partner and guide to the classes, teachers, and volunteers. The naturalist is the expert in the outdoor piece, Lang said. They know the bees, the pollination. They become the guide working with the classroom teacher, integrating the science curriculum. In addition to educating the students, Dubuque County Conservation Board Executive Director Brian Preston said the program also could help the local park system. Some of the program's goals include exposing and engaging students and families with the park system, with an emphasis on underrepresented populations. I think it's a great opportunity for students and for us to expand the goals of conservation and outdoor education, Preston said. Now for news in brief, rural Dubuque man sentenced in jail time probation for cutting ex-girlfriend with knife. A rural Dubuque man has been sentenced to 32 days of incarceration and 2 years of probation for cutting his ex-girlfriend with a steak knife. Devon M. Ward, 27, was given the sentence Monday in an Iowa District Court of Dubuque County after pleading guilty to charges of domestic assault with a dangerous weapon and second-degree harassment. As part of a plea deal, charges of domestic assault, impeding airflow, domestic assault causing injury, and child endangerment were dismissed. Ward received credit for time already served. He must also comply with a no-contact order issued for Madeline J. Grant of 27 and complete the Iowa Domestic Abuse Program. Court documents state that Grant and Ward got into an argument when Grant picked up some belongings from Ward's residence on February 21. Grant told authorities that Ward, quote, grabbed her by the throat from behind and attempted to stab her with a steak knife, end quote. Grant pushed Ward away, but he then placed her in a headlock. When Grant took her belongings to the front door, Ward began stabbing at the garbage bags containing her belongings, documents state. Grant had a laceration to her finger. In addition to his sentence for assaulting Grant, Ward was also sentenced Monday to 2 days of incarceration for unrelated domestic abuse with strangulation and child endangerment charges. Those charges stemmed from an incident that occurred in November. U.S. Marshals say that a man arrested in Zwingle on drug trafficking charges. An Illinois man was arrested by federal law enforcement officials in Zwingle on drug trafficking charges Wednesday. Eutavius Davenport, 39, faces charges of conspiracy to distribute heroin and fentanyl. He was indicted by a grand jury in the Western District of Missouri in June 2020 on federal charges out of Springfield, Missouri. Officials had been looking for him since then, according to a press release from the U.S. Marshals Service. Marshals tracked Davenport through multiple states over the ensuing months and eventually developed a likely location for Davenport in a rural setting just north of Swingle, the release said. Law enforcement officials joined with marshals from multiple states to arrest Davenport on Wednesday. He was transported to the Linn County Correctional Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to await extradition to Missouri. And the Wisconsin Assembly passes a bill directing the governor to reopen Wisconsin historic sites. The Wisconsin Assembly has passed legislation directing the state to reopen historic sites that have been closed since last year. Representative Todd Novak, a Republican from Dodgeville, authored Assembly Bill 391 with Representative Travis Trinnell, a Republican from Cuba City, according to the press release. The bill directs Governor Tony Evers to reopen the sites with funds from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. Half of the closed sites are located in area counties, First Capital in Belmont, Pendarvis in Mineral Point, Stonefield in Cassville, and Villa Lewis, I'm not sure what that is, in Prairie du Chien. The First Capital is celebrating its 185th anniversary this year. The Wisconsin Historical Society earlier this year announced that the site would remain closed until April 2022 as the agency deals with budget cuts and pandemic-related shortfalls. The legislation now heads to the Wisconsin Senate for consideration, and it must pass both the chambers in the same form before it heads to Evers for consideration. And we'll wrap up page two with the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Department reports. David P. Style, 47, no permanent address listed, was arrested at 1:58 a.m. Wednesday in the 9000 block of Noonan Street on charges of possession of methamphetamine, possession of drug paraphernalia, and interference with official acts and a warrant for violation of pretrial supervision. David L. Cunningham, 48, of 1895 Central Avenue, number 4, was arrested at 10:29 p.m. Tuesday at his residence on charges of domestic assault with injury and false imprisonment. Court documents state that Cunningham assaulted Tiffany L. Breitspecker, 31, of the same address. And here is the Telegraph Herald's recap of changes in local COVID-19 testing and vaccination, including Wednesday's developments. First, three additional cases of COVID-19 were reported in Dubuque County between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday. One additional case was reported in Clayton and Jones County each in Iowa and in Grant County, Wisconsin. Meanwhile, one fewer case was reported in Joe Davies County, Illinois. As of Wednesday, 146,037 residents of the Telegraph Herald's coverage area were fully vaccinated, which is 56.4% of the area's population of those 12 and older. The next Dubuque County walk-in vaccination clinic will be held from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Friday, June 25th, that's tomorrow, at Kennedy Mall. You can see a full list of vaccination sites at bit.ly/3UETQNO. The state of Iowa provided new county-level hospitalization data on Wednesday. The most recent data showed that as of Tuesday, three residents of Dubuque County with COVID-19 were hospitalized. No such residents of Clayton, Delaware, Jackson, or Jones counties were hospitalized at that time. Iowa reported 81 additional residents with COVID-19 in the 24-hour period that ended at 5 p.m. Wednesday, increasing the state's total to 373,314. The state's death toll rose by 3 for a total of 6,120. As of Wednesday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that 1,488,643 Iowans had been fully vaccinated, or 55.6% of the state's residents who are at least 12 years old. In Wisconsin, a walk-in COVID-19 vaccination clinic will be held today from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Royce Hall on the University of Wisconsin-Platteville campus. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services reported 96 additional confirmed cases of COVID-19, raising the total to 612,329. The state's death toll rose by 8, for a total of 7,261. As of Wednesday, 2,798,626 Wisconsin residents had been fully vaccinated. That's 56% of the state's residents who are at least 12 years old. Illinois reported 1,389,892 COVID-19 cases as of Wednesday, an increase of 258 cases from Tuesday. The state's death toll rose by 8 to 23,173. As of Wednesday, 5,637,499 Illinois residents have been fully vaccinated, 52% of the state's residents who are at least 12 years old. You're listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 24th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. The first is for Dwayne Beecher. On June 18, 2021, Dwayne Beecher finally got to leave the body that had tried to hold him down for 28 years. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until noon Saturday, June 26, at 2021, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service at 3860 Asbury Road, Dubuque. The celebration of Dwayne's life will begin at noon at the funeral home on Saturday, June 26, 2021. The service will be live-streamed on Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later on the funeral home's website. Dwayne was born on January 30, 1955, the son of John, called Jack Beecher, and Flora Lou Morgan Beecher. He attended Resurrection Grade School and graduated from Wallert High School. On August 31, 1973, he married the love of his life, Joanne Clower. Together, they created four beautiful sons and were foster parents and daycare providers. Dwayne worked at Beecher Gas Station, the company started by his grandfather, and the place where he met his future wife. He went on to work for Beecher Quarries, Chigfrey Excavation Company, River City Stone, and eventually Eli Barge Services as a heavy equipment operator and truck driver. He took great pride in his work, even when he was severely challenged by Iowa winters and summers. He was always the guy who was there for everybody, no matter what they needed. In 1993, Dwayne's body started to rebel. Over the next 28 years, he was bombarded by one ailment after another. There were good times and very bad times, but through it all, Dwayne and Joanne kept loving and living and fighting back. In 2003, he was diagnosed with laryngeal cancer and started the fight for his life. He endured the cancer treatment with grace and dignity. He eventually had his larynx removed. He learned to speak esophageal speech and was very proud that he could be good at a technique that is really very difficult. Dwayne looked forward to the Cancer Society Relay for Life each year. He walked 9 times as a cancer survivor. 5 years ago, the radiation damage took its toll on his body. He went to the Mayo Clinic, where he had to have his esophagus removed. This meant that his wonderful method of speech was now impossible, and he would never be able to eat. But Dwayne always had a smile on his face and a kind word for everyone he met. The last 5 years were very difficult, and it was hard for him to keep going. He was getting tired, and the fight was very hard. After a final fight in the hospital, he quietly rose to heaven, surrounded by his family in the home they all shared for 42 years. Dwayne is survived by his wife of nearly 48 years and his 4 sons, Tim, married to Molly of Dubuque, Jeff of Dubuque, Andy, married to Jennifer of Davenport, and Ed of Dubuque. He has also left 9 grandchildren, with another on the way: Evan, Maddie, Emily, Allie, Sam, Bailey, Paisley, Roman, and River. He's also survived by his siblings: Mike, married to Connie of Sedalia, Missouri; Marty, married to Sandy of Panama City, Florida; Joe, married to Vicky of Oskaloosa, Iowa; John of Dubuque; and Christina Barron of Chicago, Illinois. two aunts, Betty Beecher and Pat Myers, lots of nieces and nephews and cousins, and his two little dogs, Willow and Norman, who were his greatest source of smiles in his life. Duane is preceded in death by his parents, Jack and Flora Beecher, his in-laws, Herbert and Bernadette Clower, all of his grandparents, and three brothers-in-law that he thought the world of. The family would like to thank all the people who gave special care to Duane over all these years, Dr. John Hartman, Dr. Tim King, Dr. Ryan Stiley, Dr. Mark Jones, Dr. K. Robert Shin, the wonderful nurses at Mercy One in Dubuque and in the ICU in the sixth floor of St. Mary's Mayo Hospital in Rochester, and a special thanks to Nurse Sandy Radke, who along with Duane started a laryngectomy support group so other survivors of laryngeal cancer could tell their stories. Thank you to LynnCare Home Medical Equipment and Mercy One Home Medical Equipment for their great service. Thank you to the pharmacists at Hy-Vee on Locust in Dubuque. And of course, thank you to Hospice of Dubuque. There have been so many people involved in making Duane's life a little easier for him, and they will all tell you what a sweet and loving patient he was to take care of. Duane loved his gardens and nature in general. It would be his wish that you do not send cut flowers to the funeral home, but would greatly prefer that you send a plant, plant some flowers, or go for a walk in the woods, or plant a tree to be a reminder of the life of this wonderful man. Condolences may be sent to the family by visiting Duane's obituary on the Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home website. Our next obituary is for Duane Schlemme of Cascade, Iowa. Duane G. Schlemme, 78, of Cascade, Iowa, and formerly of Bernard, Iowa, passed away after a brief illness on Monday, June 21, 2021, at his home in Cascade, Iowa, with his wife by his side. Visitation for Duane will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, June 25, 2021, at the Rife Funeral Home in Cascade, Iowa, where a wake service will be held at 3:30 p.m., a Knights of Columbus Rosary will be held at 7 p.m. Friends may also call after 8:30 a.m. Saturday, June 26th, at the funeral home. Anyone not able to attend may send memorials to Rife Funeral Home, Attention Duane Schlemme Family, Post Office Box 430, Cascade, Iowa, 52033. Services for Duane will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 26th, 2021, at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade, with Reverend Mark Osterhaus presiding. Burial will be held in Calvary Cemetery in Cascade, Iowa. Duane was born October 13, 1942, in Monticello, Iowa, son of George and Marie Copes Schlemme. He received his education in the rural Bernard schools. On October 24, 1961, he was united in marriage to Muriel Matternach of the former St. Mary's Catholic Church in Cascade. The couple farmed in the Bernard area. In 2000, they moved to Cascade, and Duane worked for Cascade Lumber and Manufacturing. They also cleaned St. Martin's Church. He was a member of St. Matthias Parish, a member of the Fourth Degree Dubourg Assembly, number 1573, and Cascade Knights of Columbus Council, number 930. He is survived by his wife, Muriel Schlemme of Cascade, one daughter, married to Bill Buffy Buffello in Cascade, two sons, Loris, married to Shelley Schlemme of Cascade, and Lyle, married to Tina Schlemme of Iowa Falls. Nine grandchildren, Laura Cook, Lisa, married to Adam Long, and Lacey Buffelli. Kylie, whose fiancé is Logan Kimple, Colton and Kennedy Schlemme, Alexa, Olivia, and Devin Schlemme. Four great-grandchildren, Dylan and Braden Cook, Isabella and Alice Long. Also, he's survived by one sister, Marlene Ann, married to Bob Gurness of Des Moines. Three nieces, Mary Gurness, married to John Hagen, Rebecca Gurness, married to John Athoffer, Catherine, married to Ryan Meyer, brothers and sisters-in-law, Katie Roskine of Anamosa, Joe, married to Joanne Metternach, Ralph, married to Rita Metternach, both of Cascade, Loris, married to Donna Metternach of Mason City, Joanne Hoffman, Ronnie Metternach, whose friend is Linda, Lois, married to Alan Gravel, and Lester, married to Marianne Metternach, all of Cascade, a sister-in-law, Lois Metternach of Cascade, two stepsisters, Jeanette Callahan of Dubuque and Pat Manders of Dubuque, and numerous Metternach nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his parents, a sister, Teresa Schlemme, sisters and brothers-in-law, Florence, married to Hanny Schlockelmo, Clarence, married to Eleanor Quint, Herman, married to Veronica Welter, Alvina, married to Robert Grief, Eva May, married to Elmer Clocky, Harry Roskine, Sr., Ermina Metternach, Larry Metternach, Tom Hoffman, Bridget Metternach, Jack Callahan, Don and Mary Manders, his stepmother-in-law, Millie Manders Metternach, and his father and mother-in-law, Joe and Amelia Kelchin Metternach. An online video tribute may be viewed and online condolences sent to the family at the Rife Funeral Home website. The family would like to extend a special thank you to Above and Beyond Hospice Care, especially nurses Megan and Lindsay and Sherry Kelchin, ARNP, for all their exceptional care of Dwayne and his family. Our next obituary is for Dennis Naber. Dennis J. Naber, 56, of Dyersville, Iowa, passed away on Monday, June 21, 2021, at his home in Dyersville, Iowa. Visitation for Dennis will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 24th, at the Rife Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will be continued on Friday after 8:30 a.m. at the funeral home. Anyone unable to attend may send memorials to the Rife Funeral Home. Attention, Dennis Naber family, Post Office Box 271, Dyersville, Iowa. A massive Christian burial for Dennis will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, June 25th, 2021, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with Reverend Anthony Nikita presiding. Burial will be held in St. Francis Cemetery in Dyersville. Dennis was born on January 22, 1965, in Dubuque, Iowa, son of Frank and Ann Joyce Turnus Naber. He is a 1983 graduate of Beckman High School in Dyersville. Dennis was employed at Eagle Tool as a die caster and CNC operator. He was a Honda 70 collector of mini bikes. He liked to tinker with them and was referred to as a shade tree mechanic. He enjoyed motorcycle riding and snowmobiling. He is survived by one daughter, Megan, married to Jared Fecht of Dubuque, one granddaughter, Hazel Fecht, his parents, Frank and Ann Joyce Naber of Dyersville, four siblings, Wayne, married to Jean Naber of Cedar Falls, Iowa, Roger Naber of Dyersville, Iowa, Carolyn, married to Pat Turnus of Hopkinton, Iowa, and Steve, married to Tanya Naber of Dyersville, and 11 nieces and nephews. He is preceded by one brother, Richard Naber, in 1989, preceded in death, that is. Online condolences may be left for the family at the Rife Funeral Home website. Our next obituary is for Mary Kay Martin. Mary Kay Martin, 93, of Belmont, Wisconsin, died on Monday, June 21st at Epione Pavilion in Cuba City. Massive Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 26th, at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in Cuba City. Father Dave Flanagan will officiate. Burial will be at Resurrection Cemetery, Belmont. Friends may call from 9 a.m. until the time of the service at the church. Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville is serving the family. Memorials may be made to the Mary K. Martin Memorial Fund. Online condolences can be made at the Melby website. Mary was born on January 1, 1928 in Lafayette County, daughter of Henry and Matilda Wedig Orrett. She was united in marriage to Lyle W. Martin in 1948 at St. Peter's Catholic Church in rural Lafayette County. He preceded her in death on January 1, 2001. Mary graduated from Belmont High School. Mary and Lyle farmed in Belmont Township and later moved to Belmont. She was known for her baking, cooking, and embroidery. Mary is survived by 10 children, Marcia, married to Bill Bob Hoop, Denny, married to Gail Martin, Ed, married to Gina Martin, Roger, married to Paula Martin, Janet Kowalski, Eileen Buchanan, Marilyn, married to Lou Moritz, Lori, married to Mark McComb, Ted, married to Karen Martin, and Sheila LaLumia, many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her husband Lyle, her parents, two brothers, Paul, married to Lorraine Orrett, Robert, married to Bernice Orrett, one sister, Elizabeth, married to Maynard Speth, sons-in-law Robert Kowalski, Peter Buchanan, and Andy LaLumia. And our final obituary is for Sarah E. Busan. Sarah Elizabeth Tumiskas Busan, age 45, passed away Monday, June 21st, at Javanbiya Hospital in Rockford. Sarah was born at Rockford Memorial Hospital in Rockford on December 30th, 1975, to Richard and Cindy Coffin Tumiskas. She graduated from Honanega Community High School in 1993. She worked for Cobalt Meds Plans. Sarah married the love of her life, Tony Busan, on October 11, 1997. Sarah was a dedicated, loving mother to Zeke and Ellie. She treasured her children and embraced every moment with them, especially her time spent cheering Zeke as he played rugby and Ellie as she played softball. She also loved her role as aunt to five nieces and nephews. Sarah is survived by her husband, Tony, son Zeke, and daughter Ellie of Davis Junction, Illinois. Her parents, Richard and Cindy Tumiskas of Roscoe, Illinois. Sister Brenda, married to Kurt Belfus of Roscoe, Illinois. Parents-in-law, Jeff and Georgia Busan of Galena, Illinois. Sister-in-law, Jenny, married to Sean Larson of Dubuque, Iowa. And special nieces and nephews, Brandon, Dylan, Addie, Caitlin, and Callie. All of those she loved and touched deeply. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, July 24th. 2021 from 1 to 4 p.m. at the family home. A memorial has been established in her name. You may visit the Farrell Holland website to leave condolences or a special memory of Sarah. Turning now to sports, the Cardinals earn a sweep when Maquoketa puts everything together in wins over Beckman. This was the type of performance Maquoketa wanted to see. Pitchers throwing strikes and batters riding the carousel around the base paths. Jenna Wibinga drove in four runs and was a home run short of the cycle in the opener and combined with Carly Kavanaugh for a pair of strong outings in the pitching circle as the Cardinals swept Dyersville Beckman 10-0 and 6-1 in a Waka Conference doubleheader on Wednesday at the Jack Marlowe Athletic Complex. It's probably pronounced WAMAC or something like that. Obviously, I'm not familiar with that conference, but I'll bet you are. Wibinga went 3-for-4 and scored a pair of runs in the opener, then threw a four-hitter and two strikeouts in the second game. She needed just five pitches to get through the third inning and recorded the final seven outs on just seven pitches. Same pitch for six of those batters, Cardinal coach Sarah Nelson said. Jenna has come a long way as a pitcher. She's really worked on her mental game, and that's what we needed her to do so that she can hit those spots and just trust that her defense is going to make the plays behind her and support her. Those last seven batters proved we're starting to come around and do those big things. Carly Kavanaugh threw a four-hit shutout for the Cardinals in the first game, striking out seven and issuing a single walk. Only one Beckman runner reached second base with two outs in the first inning. My confidence has struggled in the past, and the last couple of games it's been really improving, Kavanaugh said. It just really gives you more positive thoughts about the upcoming games. Wibinga singled, she singled with two outs in the first and scored on Claire Hackman's ringing double to open the first game. Michaela Birkin followed with a single to give the Cardinals a quick 2-0 lead. Wibinga's blast in the third made it 4-0. Cassidy Frazier singled home another run in the fourth, and Wibinga followed with a run-scoring double as Maquoketa took a 6-0 lead. They were throwing all inside, and that's my favorite pitch, so I was just turning it, Wibinga said. Birkin and Tinley Kavanaugh singled to open the bottom half of the fifth, and Melissa Robert beat out a bunt single with one out to load the bases. Kaylin Hackman lined a single off the glove of Beckman third baseman Shea Steffen to bring home one run, and Addie Bowman's fielder's choice drew a late throw to the plate for another. Robert scored on a wild pitch before Wibinga's fielder's choice drew another throw home, but not before Hackman came across with the game-ending run. The Cardinals didn't waste much time putting the pressure on the Blazers in the second game. Tinley Kavanaugh singled, leading off in the second, advanced to second on Carly Kavanaugh's sacrifice bunt, and stole third as Robert walked. Laney Hafner followed with a long two-run single off the fence in left center. Claire Hackman and Birkin singled to open third, and Tinley Kavanaugh doubled home to bring home the first run. Robert doubled home two more runs with one out, and Bowman reached on a fielder's choice to push the Cardinals' lead to 6-0. Lauren Osterhaus ended Wabinga's shutout bid with a solo homer to left, leading off the top of the fifth. In Major League Baseball, the Sox end a five-game skid. Yasmani Grandal hit a two-run double, and the Chicago White Sox stopped a five-game losing streak, beating the Pittsburgh Pirates 4-3 Wednesday in Pittsburgh. Lurie Garcia added a home run as the American League Central leaders ended their longest skid of the season. Chicago starter Dylan Cease, 6-3, bounced back from a rough outing to work 5 2/3 innings, allowing one earned run while striking out seven. "I did an Ozzie Smith somersault when we got that last out," manager Tony La Russa joked. "You take it too serious because this is what you do for a living, but you know, it's been kind of miserable. Five straight days, so we've had taken a win any time in there to ease the misery. If you had to pick one of the five to win, you'd pick this one." Cease was tagged for seven runs in 3 1/3 innings in his previous start at Houston. That game was the first of Chicago's slump, and Cease was happy to be the one to help end it on Wednesday. "Anytime you can help the team get a win, it's why I'm here," he said. "It's not all just me, though. Between our defense and our offense, I'm just happy to be able to do my part." Liam Hendricks pitched a perfect nine for his 19th save of the season. Grandal's tie-breaking hit came with two outs in the fifth inning and finished Pirates starter Chase DeJong, who is at 0-2. Garcia led off the second with his first home run of the season, a first pitch drive to right center. Pittsburgh scored twice in the second after Cease made two errors in attempting to field a bunt by DeJong with Michael Perez on first base. Cease first dropped the ball and then threw it away, giving the Pirate runners at second and third. Chicago outfielder Luis Gonzalez got his first big lead hit with a second-inning double and scored on Tim Anderson's double. Gonzalez made his first start with the White Sox, navigate the absence of outfielder Adam Engel, who was placed on the injured list on Tuesday. Other scores around Major League Baseball. In the American League, the Tigers beat the Cardinals 6-2. The Giants beat the Angels in 13 innings, 9-3. The Rockies beat the Mariners 5-2, and Blue Jays meet the Marlins 3-1. In the National League, the Brewers beat the Diamondbacks 3-2, and the Nationals beat the Phillies 13-12. In other games, the Astros beat the Orioles 13-0, the Rays beat the Red Sox 8-2, and that's all the scores I have. And we'll finish up today with an opinion piece from the opinion page. This is from Arthur Sear, who is Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And here is his comment entitled, "Supreme Court decisions are politically notable if they are not political." "Judges are not politicians in robes." That's a quote from Judge Neil Gorsuch, nominated for our Supreme Court in 2017. He used that phrase to emphasize the law's majesty and avoid hypothetical questions during Senate confirmation. In fact, the court employs the law to address political disputes. This month, the court has so far issued two politically notable decisions. A unanimous decision permits a Catholic social service agency in Philadelphia to discriminate against same-sex couples, overruling a lower court. The court found that equal treatment under the law is not involved since there are many other secular agencies available. Chief Justice John Roberts kept the focus narrow in writing the decision. A second unanimous decision confirmed a lower court ruling that the National Collegiate Athletic Association cannot restrict education-related benefits provided to collegiate athletes. The court found common ground in opposing monopoly power. Last June, the court struck down a Louisiana law requiring hospital admitting privileges for doctors conducting abortions, extending federal civil rights protection to LGBT employees, and protecting the children of undocumented immigrants. Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the majority in these decisions. This reversed his earlier vote on a similar abortion case, Whole Woman's Health versus Helderstedt, when he was in the conservative minority. That decision is now law and precedent. Justices should pursue the law, not personal preference. In this sense, Gorsuch was right. Our common law system is the foundation of our government. Judges should not make decisions lightly or arbitrarily. They rarely do, especially at the federal level. Yet intense partisanship charges that most controversial visible issues, including those just cited. Therefore, we should remember the great majority of Supreme Court decisions are not 5-4, but involve margins more substantial. Such cases can also be extremely controversial. An excellent example is the 2011 decision in Snyder v. Phelps regarding freedom of speech. In an 8-1 decision, the court determined a religious group could picket military funerals despite the added suffering imposed on those bereaved. The bigoted church lusts after publicity, pursued in disgusting ways, and will not be named here. The First Amendment protects its speech and ours. By contrast, in June 2012, the court narrowly upheld the Affordable Care Act, often called Obamacare, and a related law. National Federation of Independent Business versus Sebelius was decided 5-4, with Chief Justice Roberts joining the liberal justices. President Barack Obama's statement immediately after the court decision emphasized benefits for people in need, not the legal considerations. The court relied on authority to levy taxes. The Obama administration had emphasized the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution. The court has reconfirmed the act in its current session. Roberts, confirmed in 2005, is erudite, cool under pressure, and a leader who's consistently seeking consensus. In short, he is politically astute. This recalls another Chief Justice, Earl Warren. On taking office in 1953, Warren confronted a 5-4 division on the Brown versus Board of Education school desegregation case. Warren delayed voting and spent months talking with his colleagues. The ultimate vote was 9-0. Earl Warren was a successful career politician. Historically, politicians were well represented on the Supreme Court. President Abraham Lincoln elevated Treasury Secretary Salmon P. Chase, a powerful rival, to be Chief Justice. Chase excelled. Roberts has written that the founders of the United States were practical statesmen, not metaphysical philosophers. Those are Roberts' words. Overall, the court remains moderate, seeking to avoid sharp splits, despite hopes on the political right for conservative dominance. And that was the opinion of Arthur Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 24th, 2021. I'm your reader, Twyla Glenn. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.